Today's guest is Argentinian homeopath, Dr. Francisco Aizayaga. Now, anybody hearing that name who's a homeopath will probably have heard of the Aizayaga layers method. Now, this is something that I was taught at college, and embarrassingly, I did not realize that Dr. Francisco Aizayaga had a son who is a practicing homeopath in Argentina and has got 39 years of homeopathic practice behind him. So with the recent JAHC conference in Texas, I discovered that Dr. Francisco Aizayaga is in the lineup of speakers. And when I saw his name, I couldn't believe it. So I wasn't sure whether he was the son or the grandson of the famous Dr. Aizayaga that discovered the layers method. And I managed to get in touch with him and he agreed to come on the show. So it was such a huge honored to get to speak with him today. He also has two brothers who are homeopaths as well. It ended up being such a lovely conversation. The main reason for getting him on the show was to talk about the layers method, and we ended up talking about pretty much everything else except for the layers method, although we did talk about that for a bit as well. But such an incredible conversation. The bonus is that Dr. Aizayaga has an absolutely beautiful voice to listen to, so I am sure that you are really going to love this episode. Please let me know what you think by joining the Homeopathy Hangout podcast Facebook group. And you can also make some suggestions in there for guests that we can have on in future. And thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we have a super special guest, Francisco Aizayaga, all the way from Argentina. Welcome to the show, Francisco.
Well, thank you, Jenny. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's so lovely to get to chat with you. I think most homeopaths, when they listen to the show, they're going to recognize your name and know how you were first introduced to homeopathy, but some of our general listeners won't. So can you tell us the story of how you were first introduced to homeopathy?
My father was a more or less well-known homeopath in Argentina, and he started working with homeopathy in the 50s. He worked for more than 50 years, and he taught homeopathy in many different countries, in Argentina, of course, and also in places like Uruguay, Chile, Mexico, the U.S., mostly in the U.S. For the last 15 years or so of his life, he went to the U.S. like 3-4 times a year, making different seminars in different cities around the U.S.
Wow. And what was it like for you growing up in a house like that? And I think I read somewhere, did he have 8 children? Are there 8 of you?
Yes, we were 8, and 3 of us, we are MDs. Oh. And we all the 3, we do homeopathy. My older brother, Jose, and my youngest, Juan, we are all the 3 homeopaths. And Jose and I, we worked in the Universidad Maimónides, a university that teaches, in which we have a course for teaching homeopathy to MDs.
Oh, wow. And do you have to be an MD to practice homeopathy in Argentina?
Well, it's a good question. For most of the associations, or almost all of them, they teach homeopathy only to MDs. For doing a medical prescription, you have to be an MD in Argentina. But as homeopathy is only partially recognized and the homeopathic remedy is not well defined, so I think it's a bit flexible now, but most of the homeopaths here, or almost all of them, are MDs.
Jeez, that's very interesting. So you can go and get a prescription for antidepressants and some aura metallicum at the same time?
Yes, I could do that for you, but I wouldn't. I couldn't give you the antidepressant in the first place. No, it depends. I have done internal medicine, a hospital here, in a public hospital. And of course, I do prescription of allopathic medicines. I think that homeopathy has its limitations. Mm-hmm. It's not for everything. It is for everybody, although not everybody uses homeopathy here. Only, I think, between 5 and 10% of the population, especially in the big city here in Buenos Aires. But homeopathy has its limitations. There are certain pathologies in which it's difficult to prescribe only with homeopathy. So sometimes we need the aid of allopathic medicine, no? Things like hypertension or arrhythmia or diabetes. There are many examples. Although there are many cases in which homeopathy is much better than usual medicine for treatment and would be the first choice. For example, a huge problem we have now, like antibiotic resistance, I think it would not happen if homeopathy was used more often.
Yeah, I agree. That's pretty scary, actually, antibiotic resistance. And it's so unnecessary because, like you said, homeopathy, you can use so easily as a first choice medicine for mastitis or UTI. We can treat it so easily with homeopathy. There's no need for the antibiotics unless it's a last resort.
Yes. As a doctor, I prescribe antibiotics, but most of the infections that I see, I treat them only with homeopathy. In some cases, some different special cases, I use antibiotics.
Mm. What was it like growing up in your house? I'm just fascinated. Your father was such a huge figure in the homeopathic world. And we just talked about it before. He lived until he was 80, which is pretty impressive. And what was it like growing up in your household?
In my house, we only received homeopathic remedies. And then when I went to school, I had to learn everything about allopathic medicine because I knew anything. No, I never received an antibiotic when I went to medical school, never in my life.
Wow. So
I had to learn everything, of course. But we were always treated with homeopathy. So it was natural to us.
That's just absolutely amazing. How cool is that? And was it your first choice to go and study homeopathy after school? Or did you go and do a detour and do some other things first? Or did you know that's the path that you want to go?
I did the medical school. When I finished the medical school, I did at the same time the course of homeopathic medicine in the Homeopathic Association here, Argentine Homeopathic Association, in which my father at that time was the president.
Oh, cool.
And also at the same time, I did internal medicine in the hospital, no? Every day. And it was very, really interesting. I learned lots of things and have good friends from there. And we were grown in a home in which what we mostly did was homeopathy, but my father was never against allopathy, no? On the opposite, he always tried to keep a sense of, I don't know, balance, no? Which is the best in this case. But it is true that in ordinary frequency, most of the things can be treated initially with homeopathy. And then use allopathy if it doesn't work, or in some cases, it depends, no? Mm-hmm. It depends on the case.
Amazing. And you now have almost four decades of practice behind you.
Exactly, yes, like 39.
Wow, yes. That is incredible. Absolutely incredible. Have you got children as well? Have you continued the homeopathic lineage?
I have six children. I have lots
six
of
children.
Engineers at home. No doctors. Probably the family got oversaturated of doctors with three in the family.
That's incredible. Now, something else I was going to ask you is it easy enough to find homeopathic medicines in like the pharmacies or the health shops in Argentina, or is it not so common?
Well, as the legislation is not very clear, as is in most developed countries, there are certain pharmacies that produce their own remedy. We don't have laboratories. So it's prepared in some pharmacies that work very well. It's easy to find in Buenos Aires, which is a big city. You know, Argentina is a big country, but like half of the population lives around Buenos Aires.
Wow.
And it's more difficult. It depends where. If you go to three or four smaller cities in the interior of the country, you would get in some places homeopathy, but in Buenos Aires, it's rather easy to get, yes.
Incredible. And are the consultations or the remedies covered by your health insurance, or do the people have to pay out of pocket for all of it?
Everything is private here.
Private.
We don't have no public, no private insurance covering homeopathy. That's the difference with Brazil, for example. You know, in Brazil, homeopathy became medical specialty in 1980. Did you know that?
No.
So most of the private insurance and Many public institutions like hospitals, things like that, have homeopathic consultation or homeopathic research or things like that in Brazil. It's huge, but no, not in Buenos Aires.
That's so interesting because apparently like Brazil is also like the plastic surgery capital of the world. It sounds like most of the general public there have had surgical implants or work of some sort, but also sounds like homeopathy is thriving there.
Brazil, it's the biggest in which homeopathy is the biggest in all Latin America. It's not India, you know? But
yeah,
there are like 12,000 MDs or practicing homeopathy, which is a lot. I don't think that we are more than 1,000 here in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, no? That we are probably less than 1,000, like 900 or 1,000 MDs practicing homeopathy. But in Brazil, it's 12 times that,
wow,
at least.
And are you still lecturing at the university now? Like, are you seeing more people studying homeopathy, or are the numbers going up or down, or is it staying steady?
It's difficult to say if it's coming up or down. Argentina is going through an economical crisis, complex situation. So as they have to pay for the seminars, I don't know, maybe sometimes it comes down, sometimes it comes up. But I don't think that homeopathy is growing, no? I don't think that homeopathy is growing very much. Mm. I think that what we need in Argentina for homeopathy to grow are clear laws for the homeopathic remedy and for the practice of homeopathy.
Oh, that's very interesting. So it's a little bit too gray, and then people don't feel comfortable choosing it as a career in case things get taken away from them.
Mm, yes, of course, of course. If it were like in Brazil, probably will be growing very fast. I think so.
It's really interesting. What do you feel is stopping? What's stopping the government from putting in some good guidelines, or what's happening there?
Well, homeopathy is not recognized as a medical specialty yet in Argentina, like it is, for example, in Brazil or in Colombia. In Colombia, when it was recognized as a medical specialty, it began to grow.
Okay.
And for example, in Mexico, I think it's a medical specialty, but there is a big hospital, for example, in the city of NDF in Mexico. And we don't have that, no? We don't have that. I think in part because of our politicians, but in part is, I think we have to do some kind of,
like
how would
overhaul.
You say that? And yes, probably we as homeopaths are guilty also in the way of trying to be free of doing whatever we want to do, but we will have to be more regulated and close to public service, and that would make homeopathy more close to the people. You know? The people could have homeopathy more freely.
That's very interesting. Now, you recently had a trip to Texas for the Joint American Homeopathic Conference. And what was that like for you?
Well, that was nice. That was very, very nice. It was a huge, very interesting conference. And I gave a lecture there on a homeopathic treatment of asthma. We urgently need some research on asthma and allergic rhinitis and atopic dermatitis. That there are three issues that are clearly related and need urgent research. We don't have enough randomized controlled trials on that, and that's what we are needing. But the problem is, in which we are working now in the university, what is the interest of homeopaths in scientific research, and who's going to pay for it? In some countries, like in India or Brazil, you may have some funds from the government doing research in homeopathy. Certainly not in Argentina. We don't have any support from the government in Argentina for doing research. But homeopathy is urgently needing some, I don't know, at least 10 big randomized controlled trials. And among those trials, it should be at least one asthma trial, because homeopathy has a very good effect, in especially in children, for bronchial asthma. And the evidence we have is really poor. It's not very good. There are two negative studies that were ill-designed and had lots of methodological problems, and the results were negative, really, or too small, or badly designed, but we need at least one big trial, I think, in asthma. But the problem with homeopathy is not expensive, and research, where the randomized controlled trial has a huge cost, no? At least, I don't know, maybe $7-10 million American dollars for one trial. Yes, it is expensive.
Yeah,
so only big companies could pay that. And we don't have many big companies in homeopathy, and the ones that exist are not very, do not seem to be very interested, or they can't do it. No, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping to interview the Homeopathic Research Institute. I've been trying to get them on the show for a year, but poor Rachel's been so busy. She keeps having to reschedule. So when I have her on the show in the next couple of months, I'll definitely tell her to focus on asthma. But I would have thought that there's some good studies in India on asthma. I haven't really looked into them myself, but there's so many studies, but maybe they're not big enough. Like you're saying, you really need something with like a few thousand people.
There are not very big studies in India done with at least not randomized controlled trials that we need. And there are two studies. One was published by Thorax in 2004. And the other one is more recent, was done, I think, in Denmark. And both of them were negative. But they were, in the first place, they were too small. They had a lot of methodological problems.
It seems
it's like if they were designed to be negative.
Oh, interesting. It's sad because we have wonderful results in our clinics with asthma, homeopaths all around the world. But yeah,
I agree. Absolutely, absolutely. In bronchial asthma and in allergic rhinitis and in atopic dermatitis, homeopathy has outstanding results. Mm-hmm. And the treatment is not expensive at all. It's maybe time-consuming for the physician to establish the remedy, but it is non-expensive. And sometimes there is something that is like magic. You use a remedy like sulfur, which was used by Hahnemann like 200 years ago, and it still acts better than normal medicine that we have nowadays. No, for example, you have, sometimes you receive a child which has atopic dermatitis, has bronchial asthma and allergic rhinitis at the same time. Okay? And maybe you can use sometimes sulfur and ameliorate all the three. For an allopathic treatment of a child like that would receive at least two or three different kinds of inhalers, plus some different local treatments for the skin, and that is lots of money and complications for the child. And homeopathy sometimes has amazing results, ameliorating all the three at the same time with the same remedy. So these results make you think that even though homeopathy is old, because it's older than any allopathic medicine, still has a very interesting and could be important place to have nowadays.
Absolutely. And on top of all those medications that you would give that client, you would then have to give them medications for the side effects of the medications that they're on. So it gets really messy.
Yes.
And then we won't even talk about the suppression or the effects that they'll have later on from all the suppressive drugs that they're on. So have you got any like a special interest, or what sort of people do you see in your clinic? Do you just treat everyone, or have you got special interest?
We see all kinds of cases. I see children and adults and almost everything. And my practice is not only with homeopathy, as I do internal medicine. So I use homeopathy for most of my treatments, but I see everything. But I have done also many years of research. For example, between 2002 and 2012, I have gone to the University of Bordeaux in France for doing some research in the homeopathic delusions of aspirin with Professor Dutremé Puig there. And I worked with two chiefs there. One was Professor Dutremé Puig, and the other one that came here there was Philippe Bellon, who was the chief of research of Warona at that time. Boron Laboratories, yes.
Oh, yeah. I've had them on the show. Yeah, Christoph.
Well, he was a very important researcher, and we studied the homeopathic dilutions of aspirin, which have an effect that is the opposite of the allopathic aspirin, that increases thrombosis. And for example, what we discovered was that the effect of homeopathic aspirin is the pharmacologically, it has an effect that is completely different in big doses. Like, for example, you take 100 milligrams of aspirin, as the clinicians or cardiologists used to treat the secondary prevention, do secondary prevention for cardiovascular problems.
Mm.
And if you use aspirin 15 CH, you would have completely the opposite effect. And that will increase thrombosis. But the interesting thing is that, for example, they studied what Hahnemann had described as primary and secondary effect.
Mm.
And as the primary effect of aspirin is decreasing thrombosis by inhibiting cyclooxygenase 1, the secondary effect of aspirin is to increase thrombosis by inhibiting cyclooxygenase 2. So this is a very interesting thing that has not been proved clearly. Well, it has been studied also by the group of Dr. Bellon with histamine, but it's not, that makes us think that homeopathy has also a pharmacological effect.
Oh, that's very interesting. Okay. And why the 15 CH?
That's a good question. It's
can
a complex
worms.
Answer. Possibly, I don't know. They were already using it when I went there, and they were already studying it. We did a study in portal hypertension about that. But well, they probably, I think that they use 15 CH because in France, the high dilutions were not allowed for many, many years.
Mm.
Okay. So when they prescribed, for example, more than 30 C, they had to import it from Spain. They do it in Spain and they import it from Spain because it was not possible to produce it because of the law, yes, in France. Yes, it's not, I don't know, strange, but it was like that. So most of the French homeopaths, I used to work between 5 CH to 30 C. Okay. And why is the 15? Because possibly they think that around 15 C, which is a little bit below the Avogadro number, it comes a sort of inversion of the effect. But I think it's a preconcept. I don't think that that it works for every substance. But, well, in this case, for aspirin, it worked. The inversion of the effect was clearly observed at 15 C, but not so much at 9 C and at 5 C.
I almost can't think that a homeopathic remedy can increase thrombosis. It's very hard, even though it's made from a pharmacological product, but I guess in that low potency, it can still have a physical effect. It's very interesting.
Well, that was proved in so many experiments, you know. But what this says, what is important, the important message, is that homeopathy can be harmful too. If it's not well used, okay? If you don't know what you are doing, it could produce some harm, even in a 15C. For example, if 15C increases thrombosis, and then it could potentially increase heart power condition, for example.
Yeah. What sort of period of time did they do that? Did they do that in a Petri dish, or was it done in human subjects? And over what sort of period of time did they give the 15C?
No, that was animal research.
Okay. Oh, that's really interesting.
But they did only one single dose. Yes. And the effect is observed 1 hour after that.
Wow. Okay. That's very interesting. And with the histamine, did they use like an antihistamine or did they use like histamine?
I didn't work with the team that did the histamine studies. Okay. But they work sometimes in cell culture and they did also only one dose.
Interesting.
Yes.
Wow. Well, that certainly flips a few things on its head if you're saying that in that potency we can increase thrombosis. And you're right. We often say homeopathy is safe and effective, but you're right in the majority of cases. But yeah, it's good for us to just know We have to treat our patients responsibly. We have to know what
of course,
we're doing.
But nobody uses aspirin 15C to treat patients. You know, I wouldn't recommend that. It was done only for basic research to observe the effect and see what happened. But
very interesting.
We used it to treat hemorrhage in rats with portal hypertension and with a good effect. So in some cases, it possibly could be used, but there are no studies in humans. No. No.
Very interesting. Now, I've had so much fun chatting with you. I haven't had a chance to ask you my main question, which is,
talk to us
about the work that your father was most famous for. And have you carried that on, the layers method, which we got taught at college when I was studying in 2010? We got taught about the Isayaga layers method. And talk to us about your father's work and a little bit about, as some of the homeopaths, I spoke with a homeopath the other day and she said she'd never heard of that. And I thought that was very interesting. So maybe for anybody new, any of the homeopaths that are new listening to this, what was the work that your father pioneered and how are you still using that today?
Well, we use it every day.
Okay.
It's what we teach in our seminars. And we have the whole department of homeopathy doing that.
Wow.
And I think it's a very, I don't know why, but in many places, what they kept of that is the way in which my father explained that the disease changed the symptoms and all that, but it was not developed for that. This method was developed for making the choice of a remedy in a certain patient at a certain moment. It was an explanation of why a patient could be treated with different remedies in different situations, okay? So the patient at the same time has at some what he called constitutional, in the sense of the homeopathic constitutions that the French homeopathic doctors use, for example, a carbonic or phosphoric or sulfuric constitution. But when the patient becomes to be unbalanced, in the first place, changes the mind symptoms, mind problems, and maybe anxiety or depression or things like that, different problems. And this, it's what this has to be treated with what he called a fundamental remedy. It would be similar of what in English most of the people call constitutional, but where it's a different concept.
Okay.
And the fundamental remedy is choose based on mostly mind symptoms. And then when there are local symptoms and local problems, it depends on of the kind of the problem is dynamic problem that could change like an imbalance and with local symptoms, or it's a physical problem that has made damage in some kind of tissue in the organism. Okay. So the patient develops local symptoms. Some of them may be curable and some of them may be not. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And then he took all those symptoms separately. Yes. Mm-hmm. The constitutional symptoms, the fundamental symptoms, and the local symptoms in different bunches of symptoms.
Did he repertorize them differently or just?
Yes. When he went to the US, for example, he was a friend of David Workington, who did the MacRep, which was the first computer repertory at that time.
Yeah.
And he gave, or at least he said, I don't know, he said he gave him the idea of making different folders for different symptoms because he needed that.
So
David did that. And he did that, and the three folders of symptoms are analyzed in a separated way and all together.
Mm.
And then you see what you get. If you get all the same remedy, then it's an easy way. So that's possibly more than 50% of the patients. But in some patients, you get different remedies. And sometimes you have a remedy that is in the constitutional and in the local, but the fundamental that is different. Or sometimes you get three different remedies. And then you have to make a choice. What is more important for this patient at this time? What will be the most effective? So he analyzed the symptoms separately. And that was possibly the original thing of this method. Yes, but not for using three different remedies at the same time. What he usually did is to use only one, but he said that when the fundamental and the constitutional picture didn't cover the local picture, then the local remedy had to be used first.
Okay, that makes sense.
Because that would give a faster result for the patient, and then go to the fundamental remedy, or what I call fundamental, you would call constitutional, but no, he used constitutional, made a confusion with that, I think. But well.
Yeah, and I was just reading an article, and it was just talking about two different kind of types, like a genotypical constitution and a phenotypical constitution, and that he kind of distinguishes between the two. And I got myself a little bit confused.
He used the constitutional, as the French homeopathic doctors use it, and as a carbonic constitution, which is mostly with a fat body, with big legs, big legs, okay? Yeah. Short hands, thick hands with short fingers and with a square face. And then you have the sulfuric constitution. Could be also would have obesity, but mostly in the abdomen, or could be athletic with a more proportionate face, more rectangular proportional face and proportional fingers and hands and all that. And then the phosphoric constitution, in which you'll have a very long, thin patient with long fingers and thin hands, not thick at all. And then you have the fluoric constitution, which is asymmetric, you know, that's not so frequent.
Do you find it's hard to pick constitutional layers these days? The cases I see in my clinic are so messy. And it's really funny because just today a client said to me, what's my constitutional remedy? And last week I had two clients ask me that. And I don't know, maybe because I see so much suppression. I see so many clients that are on so many different medications. They've had the Depo-Provera shot for years on a row. They don't even know. It's so hard to see sometimes what is their real picture. Like, for example, if you had a client that's been on antidepressants for 20 years, how do you know what their constitution is? They don't even know who they are. How am I supposed to know what they
There are two questions, but it's very difficult with people that take the psychiatric remedies for so many years, no? Because things that you will not be able to change anymore. And it will be very difficult to get rid of those remedies. So you have to find a place in between in which you will try to give as small dose of the allopathic remedies as you can and use homeopathy to try to balance the patient. But sometimes it's difficult to find a constitutional or what we call fundamental constitutional remedy. Sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it is not. I think we tend to remember those that are difficult and to forget that were easy because they work well and then we forget. But it is true. And especially there are two kinds of patients that are very difficult, the ones that speak too much and the ones that they don't speak at all. The people that are very reserved, are sometimes difficult because you have two kinds of reserved patients. No? One is the patient that doesn't answer the question. He remains still and doesn't want to answer. He doesn't want to speak on difficult situations. And you have another kind of reserved patient who talks a lot, but never answers the question. tries to divert your interest to things that are not important, or makes jokes on things. But yes, those reserved patients are difficult. But you have also the people that never talk. And you have this other kind of patients that are very difficult, which are patients that have psychotic problems because it's difficult to follow their reasoning. And then what you have to do as a practitioner is you take some distance. Stop hearing the patient and think inside of what's happening here, what I'm not being able to understand what he's saying. And then you take some distance, leave the patient speaking, and then try to understand what's happening with you and with the patient. What is he really saying? What sense has what he's saying? And then you'll find the way. Well, I do that.
I do that too. I find myself in a state of surrender every single day. I just had somebody today as well with bipolar and a whole variety of very complex history, lots of drug abuse and everything else. And I found myself getting overwhelmed. And then I just had to take a breath and just sit back and just listen. What is it that really needs to be healed? Like, what is underneath all of this? There's a little voice in the background that's crying for help. What is that little voice?
Yes, that is very important, because sometimes when you do that, you are able to think in symptoms that the patient is not telling you, but they are present. You see, oh, this person is restless, or he's being loquacious or suspicious. I don't know. You may take some symptoms to which, or haughty. Not, almost nobody comes to your office and say to you, I'm haughty person.
Yeah, exactly. Haughty is
never happened to me. Okay?
Well, I found out this week that haughty comes from the French word haute. What, I don't know how you pronounce it, but that's, and it means high. Haute. So I just, yes. Yeah. It's interesting that I had another client today who, it was actually interesting because it was a phone consultation because their power was down. And as she's talking, I just started noticing I got this very irritable vibe from her. And she was so irritated. And I haven't noticed that from her before. And then it was so bad that after a while I said to her, I'm noticing that you're very irritable. I'm getting this sense that you're very irritable. What's actually going on? And then everything started coming out. But it's interesting if you just, it's the sense of it as much as what they're saying. Hey, like, what is behind everything that you're trying to tell me? Because the irritability was palpable. And once I pointed that out to her, she could.
You never end to learn from the patients. Yeah. I remember when I started my practice, I used to work for, I don't know, maybe for some years with my father at his office. Okay. And he shake hands with the patient and he heard it for, I don't know, 2 minutes. And he pointed a remedy in the repertory for me. He said, oh, he's like Napoleon, for example, or whatever. But anyway, he did everything to prove he was wrong. Okay? Because your first impression is not always good.
Mm.
Yeah. Or even if he was like very, very experienced, he did all the interview and tried to prove he was wrong with the first impression.
Interesting.
Because sometimes it's very difficult. There are some patients that are very clear, and they think the most important thing is not to take too many symptoms, but you can't not take two symptoms either. You have to keep a balance. And when a patient talks too much and says lots of things, it's easier to take lots of symptoms that are not important, really.
Mm. Yeah, I've just got a client in my mind as you're talking this. Every time I see her name pop up on my booking screen, I'm just like, oh, no, I know I have to prepare myself. There's going to be so much. And I'm always asking myself, what is behind that? What's behind that? What is it? I just want to get back to the layers. So there's the constitutional and then the miasmatic. I don't think we mentioned that one. And the fundamental and the lesional.
No. He used to take separate. Well, I don't use that too much. You know? I'm not very fond of that. But well, anyway, he used to take also miasmatic symptoms in a fourth separated row.
Mm-hmm.
And he took some miasmatic symptoms, like had to do with the kind of problem the patient has, some mind symptoms. And then he said, well, this patient is a psoriatic or, I don't know, syphilitic patient. Mm-hmm. And at some time with the fundamental remedy or didn't work completely, he used the miasmatic, nose out once a week. He usually was not the only treatment he gave. The fundamental remedy every day, and maybe, I don't know, psoriasis 200, one dose once a week.
Okay.
He added that.
I like
tuberculosis.
I like doing that as well. I like throwing in a miasmatic remedy once a week. So he wouldn't necessarily give all four remedies within a week. They would just whatever's at the
No, he never did that. He never did that.
Okay.
No, he did. For example, said, well, this patient It's just a mild depression or some anxiety, but has this osteoarthritis. So he treated the osteoarthritis when the patient was better. It, in the case in which all the three remedies were different, no? In some cases, you had the same remedy, then it would be like always the same. But when the remedies were different, he used first, in the first place, the local, and then he changed to the fundamental. But that could be, I don't know, 2 or 6 months after that. So he gave one for some time, maybe a couple of months, and then the fundamental remedy. And then, if the patient ameliorated the fundamental symptoms, he gave the constitutional. The constitutional remedy was more usually given to children, for example, that had the capacity of, I don't know, healing most of the symptoms, you know, because usually most of the children are healthier than us as adults. When you're treating an old person, possibly has some health problems that are not going to come back to normal again anymore. For example, an osteoarthritis is a good example. It, you can't make osteoarthritis disappear, no? So you have to treat it and decrease the symptoms.
So is that your main way of how you would prescribe, is still using this layers method and treating the lesional layer first if that's what's there? And then do you still prescribe in the same way?
It's what we do. With what we try to do is to use a remedy that would possibly have the most of the symptoms as possible, no? If we have, for example, a remedy that has the local picture but also the fundamental picture, then they will use that one, no? But when you have separate remedies, we use, for example, I don't know, in the case of osteoarthritis, for example, we use Roustox 6E twice a day for a couple of months, and then you could change to the other one, for example.
Do you tend to use more like the lower potencies, or do you use any LMs or mega potencies or anything else?
No, we use C. We don't. Well, sometimes I use LM. You, at some time, I started to use LM because I never had the experience to the LMs. But that was why, because my father always told me that in the early 60s, he tried the LM potencies and he found no difference between LMs and CH when used twice a day. So he switched to CH and then we did the same thing. But then sometimes I use LM. I use it in some cases. And really, I don't see a very big difference between LM, at least not in the remedies we get here, and this and the CH. But I think there is one difference, is that we use CH. At the beginning, we use low potencies, and then we use it always, almost always, once or twice a day. Now, we don't use single doses. We don't use placebo. Okay? That was what he did. Eh? That was, we are following the same practice of what he did. And that.
Well, there's a saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So if what he did was working, why
Yes.
would you change it?
Yeah, it works.
If you look over your almost 4 decades of practice, have you got
Yes.
any advice for younger homeopaths, those that are just starting out? If you look back on your journey, what advice can you give other homeopaths to help them to also have such a long career like you?
Oh, you have to be patient because homeopathy is complex. You need some experience. The most difficult thing in which you have to pay more attention is, and that you'll have to learn from an experienced professional, is to take a symptom. Yes? It's to translate what the patient is saying to a symptom that you will be able to take into consideration or you will be able to repertorize. Okay? So, you need lots of experience to understand which symptoms are more important and which are the symptoms that the patient is expressing. Sometimes the patient says in a clear way the symptom. Sometimes he does not, but you see it. You know? Sometimes you see symptoms. That's very frequent. I don't know animals, but I can imagine it would be the same thing with small children. You see the symptoms sometimes. You see the restless child. You see the child that is touching everything in your office and making some kind of question, or he's an untidy boy, or he's a tidy and yielding boy. I don't know. So you see that. Now, in adults, it's more complex. And one of the problems we have here in Buenos Aires, for example, is that there's a lot of psychoanalysis.
Okay.
And yes, one of the places in which most in the world, not possibly with Paris and New York. And
did
then
you say psychoanalysis?
Psychoanalysis.
Is that what you
Freud
said?
Therapy.
Oh, okay, okay.
Sigmund Freud. Okay.
Yeah.
But well, the problems that we have there is that many people come and say to me what the different analysts have told them.
Yeah, we have that here too.
In his life. So it's very difficult for them to analyze their life separately of what they have been told. And then you need some experience and patience.
They are hard ones to treat. I definitely have had a few of those where clients have had so much, I mean, so many psychologists and psychiatrists, and they come back and they tell you all the things that the psychologists have said about them to you as if it's their own word. And I always ask them, is that what the psychologists say? And actually something that we have here a lot in Perth is a lot of people go to see spiritual healers or kinesiologists or all those sorts of people. And then so they're talking to you as if what that person has said to them is the truth. But what we're interested in is what is their truth, not what somebody else has told them about themselves. So, yeah, we have similar.
So for some patients, they are not able to separate themselves from what they have been told.
Yeah.
So those issues are difficult. But well, anyway, in the case of the advice, I think it's to have a good experienced teacher is important, because the most difficult thing in homeopathy is to translate what the patient is saying into a bunch of symptoms that you will be able to use to search for the remedy. I knew David Workenting when he did the MacRep, no? First.
Radar Opus has been around, I think, since the 80s.
Radar is posterior. This was the first, and it was like, we could say, the modern repertoire. And
so was MacRep from the 70s.
The 80-something. 80-something. Okay. And at that time, we all thought that when we had a computer with enough power to use the homeopathic information, all the problems of the homeopath would be solved. Yeah. No, that was just common thinking at that time. You'd say, well, you can, for example, I don't know, you look too young, but for example, the Mac at that time had 1 megabyte of RAM, okay, and 20 megabytes of the hard disk, not gigabytes, megabytes, okay? So now you have a phone in your pocket, which is, I don't know, 15,000 times more more powerful than that, or maybe even more. Still, our problems are not solved, because it's always the same. The computer doesn't solve the problem, because, yes, we have lots of information in your fingertips.
We have too much information. It's too much.
Yes, now we have too much. The problem we have now is not that we don't have the information. The problem is that with all the information we have, which of that information is reliable? That's the problem now. So it just changed a lot, okay?
Yeah.
It has changed. But well, so at that time we thought that, but still the most important thing is to hear the patient and to understand what he's saying and which is the most important thing for the patient. And the other thing that my father said is that the most important thing is to hear the patient and analyze and ask him which is the problem that makes him suffer the most, okay? Which is your most important problem. Your most important problem, which that you want to improve, because sometimes I have heard many homeopathic schools that rely heavily on mind symptoms. And they are asking from a fear from the past. I don't know, but the patient has some pain in the knee or, sciatica that makes us, and that's a problem.
Or a wart. They just want the wart gone.
they want to improve the sciatica and wants the pain to go away. And the homeopath is asking about the relation with his father and say, well, is this the most important thing? Is it? Could be. It's very difficult for us as doctors not to influence what the patient is saying with our problems. So you have to be aware of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's something I learned from one of Dr. Robin Murphy's lectures, and he always said, make sure you treat what the patient came in for. And I always, at the end of every consult, every client of mine will tell you that. I always ask them, what is the main improvement you want to see when I see you next? Because the mind stuff is fascinating. It's easy to get carried away with that. But the end of the day, if you are not getting rid of that client's wart, or their hair loss, or types of things that this type of things that I see in my clinic, they're not going to come back. So you do need to.
Of course, absolutely. And the mind thing, it is very important. Mm. And sometimes a patient will say to you, I have this problem with my knee, but the problem he has is another problem, has another more complex problem. But you have to be careful with that, because sometimes you want to hear a couple of clear mind symptoms to give a simple remedy to the patient, and that will not solve the situation. As you say, has some kind of thing that is making the patient suffer a lot, and we don't get the picture. Mm. So you have to be careful with that.
It can be a pretty tricky job, hey? It can be a pretty hard job. It's definitely the most satisfying job on the planet. I can't imagine doing anything else. Like Luke Norland said the other day, because I asked in my Facebook group, what questions can I ask my guests on the show? And he suggested I ask the guests on the show, if you couldn't be a homeopath, what job would you do?
The problem that we have is that we see a very, very wide kind of different situations. For example, if I were an allopath, okay, when I have a patient that is more than like this, depressed a little bit like this, I will send it to the psychiatrist. But we don't do that. Or if he has some kind of skin problem that is more complex than a little bit like that, I would send it to the dermatologist, but we don't do that. Why don't we do that? Because we see the whole picture, and we need to see the whole patient that has very good things, but has very difficult things that are, we need to take care of all the problem, no? You have to be careful with that too, because sometimes you have to refer the patient. But as we see a very wide spectrum, you can say, of pathologies, then you have to have lots of experience, because you don't see, for example, asthma patients every day. You see sometimes asthma patients, but you have to see at least, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred of asthma patients in order to have some experience. But you need many years for that. Okay? And that's the hardest thing that we have, I think. But the other one, the good part, is that, for example, if you see a whole family, you can understand easily what is happening with its different members. That's a good part.
It is. I always say to my clients, 1 + 1 = 5. The more members of your family you add on my books, the more I can help all of them. So, Francisco, if you couldn't be a homeopath, what job would you do?
I don't know. Maybe an aeronautical engineer.
Ooh, that sounds cool.
I don't know. I don't know.
This is no other job worth doing. Now, you have written a book, and your father has just the one book, or has he written other books as well?
He wrote two books. And he translated two books from Dr. De Marque.
Okay.
Denis Demarque, homeopath from Bordeaux.
Okay.
And he also made the translation, which is an enhanced translation of the repertoire, which was a huge work. The first translation of the Kent's repertory, with 40% of adding something of different things to Spanish, from English into Spanish.
What's the first one? Him by himself.
Yes. Well, no. For the repertory, he had a team of 3 translators because it was very complex.
Yeah,
you know?
That would be huge.
At that time, he didn't have computers, no? Mm-hmm. He had to copy all the remedies and to verify.
Yeah, a typewriter.
That was awful. Yes, it was a huge work. Then.
Wow, that's incredible. I know you said you've got a book, but it's only in Spanish, right?
Yes. Yes, it's published. La toma del caso, esencia de la clínica homeopática. It's published by Similia in Mexico.
Okay.
And it's sold in DF in Mexico. And it's an explanation. It's a book. It's not a very big book, like 150 pages or something. And explaining the fundamentals of my father's way of taking the case, which I think is the most important thing he left us as a legacy. We still use that method in our university and in our offices every day. And it's really, I think it's very useful and it's practical and, I don't know, easy to apply when you know the fundamentals.
Incredible. He's left a good legacy if all these decades later, people are still using it around the world. It's pretty amazing. How can people get hold of you, Francisco? Because you're not you're a little bit hard to get hold of. Do you have a website, or if people are interested in finding out more about your work? Or we actually have loads of listeners in Mexico, by the way. So if anybody wants to get hold of you.
No, sorry. I'm not a fan of technology.
It's probably a good thing.
My brother has a website.
Is that Jose?
I have done some research in the past, mostly in biochemistry. And then I went to Bordeaux, had the opportunity to work with Dr. Dutra Mepuix and Dr. Philippe Bellon, which was really a honor. And I stayed there going for 3 times a year for more like 10 years or something.
Wow. I was going to ask if you speak French, because your pronunciation is amazing.
Oh, thank you. But yes, I speak French. I speak a little bit of German. And of course, I speak some Spanish.
I can only say, ich verstehe sie nicht. That's incredible. What an opportunity for you to get to go to France and just see how they work over there as well, far out.
I study different languages because I used to study singing. I was a bass.
Oh, that explains the beautiful voice, because I was listening to you go, you have a beautiful voice to listen to. And just thinking, our podcast listeners are going to love listening to you.
Okay, thank you, but I don't do that anymore. Okay. I love to sing in Russian, for example. Russian has wonderful music, you know.
Oh, really?
Opera, especially for the bass, yes.
Okay. I was an alto in our choir in school. Oh, that's incredible. It's actually amazing how many homeopaths I speak to that either play a musical instrument or sing or have some sort of, you know, other outlet as well. It's really cool.
Well, my father used to play the piano.
Okay.
And we all, not all of us, like 5 of us studied the piano. And I started to sing at the age of 19 years old.
Okay.
And I stopped like 7 years ago or something. It was like a huge effort, not just singing with all my work, and then to have my voice and studied opera, and was so complex.
Oh, I would so love to see you sing some Russian songs. That would be really cool.
Well, no, not anymore. I'm sorry.
Francisco, it was really such a huge privilege to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time. And it's still early in the morning over there. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show and speaking with us and sharing your message and sharing your wisdom and having us listen to your beautiful voice.
Well, thank you very much, Eugenie. It was nice to have this talk with you.
Thank you so much. Have a brilliant day. And thank you for your time.
Well, same for you, and thank you. Have a very nice day, and thank you for the opportunity of this podcast.
Such a pleasure.